Broadcasting to New York City, Los Angeles, Chicago, Sydney, London, and around the world, this is Trumpet Radio Live.
Thanks for joining us here on Trumpet Radio Live on 101.3 KPCG. Coming up on this Thursday edition, we'll take a look at some of the headlines, including the stabbing at a Michigan airport on Wednesday. Pretty interesting story there. We've got some info about that. Also, a few health notes for you, including information about vitamin D. Can you get too much of it? Some people are, and it's causing some problems. And also, sort of a new trend, I guess, in the way people are trying to make themselves appear. Does anyone grow old gracefully anymore? That and more on Trumpet Radio Live.
This is Trumpet Radio Live.
Thanks for joining us here on Trumpet Radio. This is Trumpet Radio Live on 101.3 KPCG. And we're online at kpcg.fm. Have a live link at thetrumpet.com as well. Lots of places you can listen. Also, the TuneIn app's a good app to use on a smart device of your choice. And other ways as well. But those are some of the main ones to listen here to KPCG. We appreciate that. And, of course, over the air at 101.3 in Edmond, Oklahoma City area. If you'd like to follow us on Twitter, you can do that at KPCGFM. We'll send out some tweets about our programming, keep you in the loop as to what you can expect to have aired. And also, any emails you'd like to send in, comments, questions, anything like that, comments at kpcg.fm. We appreciate you sending those in. Dwight Falk with you here today. Some headlines to start with. This tropical storm Cindy has been coming into the southern United States, Gulf Coast area, caused some rain, potential severe flooding in some areas. One death so far reported, a boy was killed with, drowning. But there's something else to watch out for when you have a tropical storm or flooding or anything like that. And this is just kind of an interesting one to start with. I had not heard of this, but it can be quite serious, especially if you're here in the South United States. Fire ants, that's an issue that people try to stay away from, obviously. You've probably seen those giant anthills in different places. They bite or sting, and they're very uncomfortable. And this headline says, watch out for floating fire ants. Floating fire ants. As Tropical Storm Cindy moves into Alabama, bringing potential flooding to the state, the Alabama Cooperative Extension System is reminding residents to be wary of displaced, sometimes floating fire ant colonies during and after flooding. So any place you have fire ants, you could have this occur if you have flooding in that area. The floods don't kill the fire ants. They just move the colonies around, according to people that look at this sort of thing. The ants join together by the thousands, trapping enough air to float on the water surface in a makeshift life raft and survive for days, weeks, or even months until they find dry land again. You can find photos of it. They join together and make this huge floating mass. And if you've seen fire ant colonies, they're pretty large. And so they band together. They form this sort of temporary raft of ants, I guess, if you want to call it that. And they float around. They say if a person encounters one of these floating balls of fire ants, it can be seriously bad news, causing potentially serious health problems, not to mention many painful bites. Probably if you get bit by one ant, it wouldn't be too bad. It would be painful, but obviously the issue becomes if you're bit a lot of times by lots of ants. And, of course, some people would have allergies, I suppose, too. The extension entomologists recommend the following during times of flooding. They say avoid contact with floating masses of fire ants. Seems like a given, but I suppose they have to put that out there. It'd be easy enough to not know what it is. You see this mass of something floating at you, you're not sure what it is, not, you know, realizing it's fire ants. They say also if you are in a rowboat, do not touch the ants with oars. I suppose they just run on up those oars and come right after you. They say when working in floodwaters, dress appropriately if possible. Rubber boots, rain gear, and cuffed gloves can help prevent ants from reaching the skin. They say if ants contact the skin, of course, they will sting. Remove ants immediately by rubbing them off. Ants will only cling to the skin if submerged. Even a high-pressure water spray may not dislodge them. However, a spray of diluted biodegradable dishwashing liquid may help immobilize and drown them. And when returning to flooded structures, they say floating ant masses are occasionally encountered even indoors. So that would be something I would not have thought of. Obviously, with a flood or a flooding situation, there's a lot of things to be concerned about. I would not have thought about floating fire ant balls. So something to think about, especially as some of these tropical storms move in, if you're listening down in some of those southern regions of the U.S. And, of course, you can have flooding anywhere. I guess it just would have to be an area where there are fire ants. After the floods, ant colonies may have relocated to new areas, they say, especially under debris piles, so caution is recommended. Insect repellents may work to deter foraging fire ants from clinging to you, but are unlikely to be effective if the ants are defending their colony. And so the extension recommends using a fast-acting aerosol insecticide containing pyrethrins if fire ants are detected among flood debris, and try to get rid of those. So pretty interesting. I've had fire ants in my yard. Got rid of them, thankfully. Never have had a flooding issue there, thankfully. But they are around, and so if you do have fire ants in your area and there's a flood, it is something to watch for. Here's a headline today that probably caught a lot of people's attention, especially those listening to this radio station. Here's a headline. It's from Prince Harry in the UK. No royal wants to be king or queen, he says. No royal wants to be king or queen. In an interview with Newsweek, Prince Harry said the monarchy was a force for good, but suggested that he and his older brother, Prince William, are trying to overhaul its image. He says, "We are involved in modernizing the British monarchy. We are not doing this for ourselves, but for the greater good of the people." I'm not exactly sure how they're doing that, but that's what he said they're doing. He said, "Is there any one of the royal family who wants to be king or queen? I don't think so, but we will carry out our duties at the right time." The write-up says, despite the prince's desire for a normal life, he also told Newsweek that he understood the appeal of the royal family. He said, "We don't want to dilute the magic. The British public and the whole world need institutions like it." So some of the comments that Prince Harry made, he's been in the media more lately, talking about some of his experiences and some of his life, and opening up about a few things. So an interesting comment from him. Could be taken a few ways, I suppose, but that's what he says. Prince Harry says, no royal wants to be king or queen, and they're trying to modernize that institution. Related to that, the European Council Summit in Brussels is starting. And, of course, a lot of the talk there is about the upcoming Brexit. And they're all trying to play nice, I guess, and at least say the right things in public as they try to figure out how are you going to take the UK out of the EU and still have it work in some fashion, have them work together in some way. European Union leaders gathered on Thursday in Brussels at a council summit to weigh measures to tackle terrorism, which, of course, is a huge issue, closer defense ties and migration, convinced that anti-EU sentiment and support for populist parties is waning. So the EU is trying to get more unified. They're trying to get closer together. Before the two-day meeting in Brussels starting today, summit chairman Donald Tusk trumpeted the resurgence of the EU, even as Britain launched talks this week on leaving. So two different agendas going on there. Striking a conciliatory tone, British Prime Minister Theresa May said there had been a constructive start to negotiations as the United Kingdom prepares to depart the bloc. She stressed that her priority is to settle the issue of EU citizens living in the UK and British citizens living in the EU, proposals on which she said she would set out during the summit. Here were some of her comments.
We will be going into negotiations. Those have started constructively. What I'm going to be setting out today is clearly how the United Kingdom proposes to protect the rights of EU citizens living in the UK and see the rights of UK citizens living in Europe protected. That's been an important issue. We've wanted it to be one of the early issues that was considered in the negotiations. That is now the case. That work is starting. We will be setting out how we propose to ensure that EU citizens living in the UK have their rights protected in the United Kingdom. Thank you.
Some of the comments there from Theresa May at the beginning of this EU Council summit. And so they have their agenda. They have their things they're trying to do from the UK side of it. The rest of the EU has their agenda, and we'll see if those two things match up. Obviously, they probably won't on several issues, and probably some pretty main issues as well. So we'll see how that progresses. More updates about that at the trumpet.com, so make sure you do check that out in the days ahead. Here's a story that was breaking news on Wednesday. Top story for a while and then sort of went off the headlines. But there was a stabbing there in the Michigan airport. And could be terror-related in some fashion, though they don't think it's part of a bigger terror plot or anything. But they do think that this person could be considered a terrorist in some ways. And it says the FBI says that it was a Canadian man charged with stabbing at an airport. He stabbed an officer in the neck in Flint, Michigan. He made references during the attack to people being killed in Syria, Iraq, and Afghanistan. So you can imagine the terror in an airport, seeing this happen, also for the officers. Just somebody randomly comes up and starts attacking you out of the blue. And so they're on edge, and I think we could all understand why they would be. Special Agent in Charge David Galeos says authorities are investigating the attack as an act of terrorism. He says authorities have no indication at this time that it was some wider plot, but the investigation is in its early stages. Here are his comments.
We are investigating this incident today that happened at about 9:45 this morning as an act of terrorism. We have just filed a complaint charging an individual by the name of Amor Fatui. He's a 50-year-old resident of Canada who legally entered the United States in Lake Champlain, New York on June 16th and made his way to Flint and today arrived at the Flint International Airport. Obviously, I know a lot more about this, and we're sort of at 0 hour of this investigation right now. And since it is a pending investigation, I'm not going to go into great detail as to what we do know. But we do know Mr. Fatui entered the airport. He spent a little time on the first level. Then he went upstairs. He spent some time in the restaurant up there. And then he came out. He was carrying baggage. He went into a restroom. He spent a little time in the restroom, dropped both bags and came out, pulled out a knife, yelled Allah Akbar, and stabbed Lieutenant Neville in the neck. As was mentioned by the chief, he's in stable condition and is expected to fully recover, and that's the most blessed thing I think we can say about this today.
And that's Special Agent in Charge of that investigation, David Galeos, talking about that Michigan airport stabbing yesterday. Fatui spent some time in the public, as he said there. He was in those unsecured areas of the airport, and then he emerged and yelling Allah Akbar, etc., and attacked the officer there with a 12-inch knife with the 8-inch blade on it. So definitely it's getting more nerve-wracking to fly. There was a related story yesterday, a survey showing that a lot of people, I think it was over 30% or so, of people surveyed here in the United States are staying away from larger public events where there's more people because of a fear of terrorism. Obviously, when you're taking public transport, public transit like airplanes or trains or things like that, you don't really have much of a choice. You're going to be around a lot of other people. And so it is terrifying, especially when these things are random. Thankfully, the officer is, I guess, in stable condition, so it seems like he'll be okay. But what a horrifying ideal, right? So it is really this is the times we live in. A lot of terrorism there, and people on edge, people nervous about that. That came out of Michigan yesterday. Well, some states in the United States, as you are well aware, have legalized marijuana recreationally, I guess they call it. And there's a new study out showing that legal marijuana and car crashes are having, there's a link between the two of them. Of course, some people are up in arms about this and don't agree with it, but here are the study results. They say legalized recreational marijuana use in Colorado, Oregon, and Washington correlates to about a 3% increase in auto collision claim frequencies compared to states without such legislation, according to a new Highway Loss Data Institute study. In the first one, the group has conducted since the drug went on sale legally. So this is the first study that they've done since that time, been a few years, I guess. Colorado saw the largest estimated increase in claim frequency, more accidents, 14% more than its bordering states. Washington State was 6% greater, and Oregon had a 4% increase. So altogether, when they add it all up, they're saying it's about 3% across the board, 3% more accidents in states where marijuana is legal, as opposed to those where it's not. And if you read the comments in the story, now this is a subject people hold near and dear to their hearts in a lot of cases. Some people really think it's fine. They don't have a problem with the legalization of this drug. Other people are against it. But the comments were split. Some people said, you can't believe these studies. There's no correlation between the two. Others said, yes, there obviously is. One person said, well, when people finally figure out that they just have to not drive when they're smoking it, then it'll all be okay. But those are the numbers. There is an increase. Now, some people are saying there's that increase is not related, but this study seems to think that it is. I would tend to agree with the study. Doesn't seem like a good idea on any level. So that's from CBS News. I think a few other states are going to be legalizing it pretty soon, or it's in the works, according to some stories that I've read, so I don't have all that updated info, but it certainly is can be more dangerous in some of those states legalizing marijuana. Here's an interesting story that happened today. It's kind of, sort of an odd one, but it probably a good warning. You might have this particular device they're talking about in your house. It could be dangerous. The headline is this: a French Instagram fitness star is killed by exploding whipped cream canister. So it seems like kind of an odd headline, but I think I don't know if we still have one. We used to have one of these. The lady died after the whipped cream dispenser exploded and it hit her in the chest, stopped her heart. And the dispensers, and you maybe you've seen these, they shoot gas into a metal capsule which keeps the pressure high. The BBC said a French consumer group had warned readers for years about faulty connectors that could break, allowing the gas capsules to be expelled at high speed. You know, basically, it's like a little gun shooting this metal capsule out. The BBC said such dispensers were involved in enough accidents that the Government Office for Consumers issued a warning saying the accidents stretched back as far as 2010 and could occur even after years of use. So if you have one of these whipped cream canisters, I think the one we have or had was sort of a white container, and you put these cartridges in it, and then you put in the I guess whatever it is, the whipped cream, and then it makes it really quickly, very efficiently, it's very fast. It's nice if you're having a cup of coffee, you want that in there, put it on dessert, whatever. It is handy, but it can have problems and it can explode. And in this case, actually killed this lady. So probably that's a pretty extreme case, but you can imagine if you have a projectile traveling at a high speed, it could put an eye out, it could cause some damage. So sort of a freak accident, sort of an odd headline, but you might have one of those in your house. So, and like they said, even after years of use, if you've been using it for a long time, it could go bad and you could have problems. So something to keep in mind, a little safety tip there that might be helpful. Couple of health notes to mention today. This headline says people are taking too much vitamin D. That's not a good thing. Vitamin D, as you probably are aware, is the so-called sunshine vitamin, and it helps promote healthy bones. It's called the sunshine vitamin because you get it from the sunshine. Also, I think you can get it from oranges and other things. But people need to be outside to get good vitamin D and get some sunshine. But then, of course, there's always a threat, I guess, of too much sunshine, so you got to be careful with it. But Americans, they say, have been low on vitamin D. I don't know about the rest of the world, but this study focuses on Americans. But they say that, so what people have been doing, of course, is a lot of times if they feel like they're low on something, they take supplements. And the problem with that can be you might be taking too much supplements. Vitamin D is a good thing, but too much of it, not a good thing. They say if you take too much, if you take more than you need, it's possible to overdose on it in a way. It can cause a range of issues, including nausea, vomiting, muscle weakness, and kidney problems. And at very, very high levels, it can even lead to heart attacks. So that would be pretty rare, but still it can happen. It is rare to have vitamin D toxicity, but too much of it can cause some difficulties for your body. So anyway, if you take some supplements, that might be something to think about, with vitamin D in particular. And a related health note to that is the obesity rates that we've seen in this country. Lack of vitamins, too much other things, and not enough movement. That's even occurring in the younger population. Sedentary lifestyles causing problems, even among teens. We have a report on that from KPCG reporter Gino Chi.
You're listening to 101.3 KPCG. This is Gino Chi. Recent studies have revealed that obesity in America shows no signs of slowing, and the reason why it's so widespread can be traced to an increasingly sedentary lifestyle that keeps people inactive and eating for more hours of the day. What's even more surprising and sad is that this research reveals that teens are just as sedentary as 60-year-olds. I remember my teenage years were spent playing sports and going outside, but now that's not the case. The problem is especially concerning among children and teens, according to the latest study published in Preventive Medicine. So the study analyzed data from the National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey from 2003 to 2004 and 2005 to 2006. So in the study, more than 12,500 people ages 6 to 84 years old wore activity trackers to log how many of their waking hours is spent being active and how many is being spent being sedentary. So as you would expect, and not surprisingly, the older people got, the less active they were. But the slowdown starts at age 35, a time of increasing demands of work and family responsibilities. By older age, medical issues and chronic diseases may prevent people from being physically active as they would like. So people in their 20s were the only age group to show increases in physical activity, especially in the early morning compared to adolescents. The most alarming data came from children and teens. So while young children are often thought to be the most active, the numbers showed that the rates of exercise actually declined during teenage years. In fact, 19-year-olds spend as much time being inactive and sedentary as 60-year-olds. Study's senior author Vadim Zipunikov says it was definitely a big surprise. So America's teens are as sedentary as 60-year-olds. According to the World Health Organization, children should get at least an hour of moderate to vigorous exercise a day. But the study showed that among kids ages 6 to 11, 25% of boys and 50% of girls did not meet this recommendation. And even more teens fell short of the guidelines. So 50% of adolescent boys and 75% of teen girls weren't active for at least an hour a day. That's really sad. The study author continues, kids may not be getting as much exercise because they're not getting enough sleep and are too tired to be physically active. One of the major contributors to low levels of physical activity in children and teens might be that they don't get enough sleep. To reverse this trend, schools must rediscover the value of physical activity in a balanced education. More importantly, parents must accept responsibility for teaching children how to live. Please visit our website, thetrumpet.com, and read the article, Problems Keep Getting Bigger. You are listening to 101.3 KPCG. This is Gino Uchi. You can join us online at kpcg.fm, and we also have a live link at thetrumpet.com.
And that's a report there from Gino Chi. You can hear some of his segments throughout the day. He has very interesting info that he likes to pass on, including some of those health tips. And that's a good one there. Just that, and a sad trend too, that young people, teens, not as active as they should be. Still, but not getting enough sleep either. So that's sort of the paradox, that they're not active, but they're not sleeping. So lack of sleep, lack of activity is adding up to a lot of problems. And of course, sometimes you can not, or you can go on for a while with that and not think that it's causing problems to your health. But then when you get older, some of those things do show up, some of those issues maybe from being younger. Here's an interesting story out of Australia. This is a topic that's been publicly debated, I guess, on and off over the years, maybe not quite as much anymore, but it was a bigger issue years ago. And that is the issue of breastfeeding in public, particularly with women going to work shortly after having a baby. What do they do in that situation if they choose to breastfeed? Well, this happened in Australia, where they don't have a problem with it, I suppose. But it it took center stage because Australian politician Larissa Waters reportedly made history when she breastfed her baby while moving a motion in the Australian Parliament. So she was actually standing up, speaking, trying to get something going there, moving a motion in the government, in the Australian Parliament, while nursing her baby at that exact moment. So it was they had the video of it, and it was, I mean, it was a little, maybe a little awkward, I'm not sure. It says local media reported that Waters' three-month-old daughter has been a regular visitor to the Senate chamber since May and had previously made history as the first baby to be nursed in the federal parliament. On Thursday, she was actually being fed while the senator was on her feet to move a motion relating to black lung disease, according to local media. So a variety of opinions probably on if that's a good thing or not. Definitely seemed a bit awkward for everyone. They tried to act like nothing was out of the ordinary, but you could tell just from watching the video that people were a little bit uncomfortable with it. And she had a hard time holding on to the kid, too. So anyway, an interesting story there coming out of Australia that ends up being sort of a an issue sometimes, depending on where people are, whether they're, like I say, on public transportation or other places. Is it a private thing? Do you do it in public? A lot of thoughts there, but that happened in the government, actually. They're building in Australia, and that was just earlier today, actually. You're listening to Trumper Radio Live here on 101.3 KPCG, and we're online at kpcg.fm. We appreciate you joining us here on this Thursday edition of Trumper Radio Live. And you can follow us on Twitter if you'd like to at kpcgfm. Also, email us any comments you have, comments@kpcg.fm. Today is the 22nd of June. Here's a couple of interesting historical notes. 1772 on this day, slavery was outlawed in England, which is a very good thing. Technically, slavery isn't legal anywhere in the world today. Niger outlawed it in 2003, and some other nations had it legalized up till 2007. But of course, still, there is illegal human trafficking, and some nations treat their lowest-level workers as essentially slaves, particularly in some of the Middle Eastern nations. So, technically, slavery isn't legal anywhere in the world. But then again, there's a lot of things going on in the world that aren't legal. But 1772, slavery outlawed in England. 1911 on this day, King George V of England was crowned, and he reigned until his death in 1936. During his reign, saw the rise of socialism, communism, fascism, Irish republicanism, and the Indian independence movement, all of which radically changed the political landscape. The Parliament Act of 1911 established the supremacy of the elected British House of Commons over the unelected House of Lords. So King George V of England crowned in 1911. 1933 on this day, Germany became a one political party country when Hitler banned parties other than the Nazis. Of course, that did not end well, as we all know. Here are some facts about Hitler that you may not know. He was selected as Time Magazine's Man of the Year in 1938. So Time Magazine, they always do their Person of the Year, I guess. And sometimes maybe they pick somebody that's worth looking at, and other times they don't. He was influential, that's for sure, but Time Magazine selected Hitler as Man of the Year in 1938. Also, Hitler was nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize in 1939. There was a time when people did look up to him in more of a positive light. They do say, however, though, that Hitler's nomination was supposed to be an irony and a joke. E.G.C. Brandt, a member of the Swedish Parliament, nominated Adolf Hitler for the Peace Prize in 1939. They say his intention was to satirically criticize the Swedish government, but it was not well received, and he was forced to withdraw the nomination. Stalin also was nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize twice, for his contributions to World War II. So he's been known, obviously is known as somebody that murdered many, many people. So kind of interesting how they look at some of that. Also, Hitler's original family name, I didn't know this, his original name was Schickelgruber. It doesn't have quite the ring to it, I guess, as the other one does. But he didn't know his father, and he took on stepfather's name, which is pronounced and written several different ways, but ended up with Hitler. But the original name was Schickel Gruber. And also, Hitler shaved part of his mustache because his full mustache nearly killed him. In World War I, he had a full mustache, and they needed to put on gas masks. And he couldn't get an airtight lock because of his, he had quite a large mustache. So they told him to shave it off, and he didn't want to shave the whole thing, so he just shaved the sides and ended up with the infamous stash that he had. So I did not know that either. A couple of interesting notes there about Adolf Hitler, who on this day in 1933 led Germany to become a one political party, and no one besides the Nazis. 1992, on this day, the U.S. Supreme Court unanimously ruled that hate crime laws that ban cross-burning and similar expressions of racial bias violated free speech rights. That's what the Supreme Court decided in 1992. Make sure you listen for the Key of David program. It's coming up here in a bit on KPCG. Also, the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Richard Palmer today from Edstone, England. A few sub-hosts for Stephen Fleury over this next few days. But people you're familiar with, you've heard on other shows, and the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Richard Palmer today, there from Edstone, England. Make sure you listen for that. Also, you can get the archives online at kpcg.fm and thetrumpet.com if you can't catch it live. Stop and check out thetrumpet.com today. Top story, France's radical election result could transform the EU. You can read that. Also, the next Eurozone crisis and how Europe will react. Related to that, why the euro is heading for an earth-shaking crisis. Those headlines are at thetrumpet.com. Make sure you do stop and check those out. You are listening to Trumpet Radio Live here on 101.3 KPCG. And online, we're at kpcg.fm. We have a live link at thetrumpet.com. We'll take a break, and when we come back, we'll take a look at an interesting trend as far as growing old gracefully. Turns out that people just aren't doing it anymore. We'll take a look at that next here on Trumpet Radio Live.
Is summer vacation drying your brain into a wrinkled raisin? Plunge into something different. Join Dennis Leap, host of Just the Best Literature, for a scintillating summer of reading. Drench your mind with classics such as Jane Austen's Pride and Prejudice, Charles Dickens' Great Expectations, and Jules Verne's 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. Be a part of reading and discussing to build a brawny brain. Yeah! JBL's Summer of Classics series begins June 26th. Just the Best Literature airs Mondays at 8 a.m. CDT on kpcg.fm and 101.3 in North Edmond, Oklahoma. Join us on Twitter at JBLiterature1 or on Facebook by searching Just the Best Literature to see news, facts, and creatively designed quotes. Also, leave comments and communicate with us. We want to hear from you. Just the Best Literature airs Mondays at 8 a.m. on kpcg.fm and 101.3 in North Edmond, Oklahoma.
Hi, I'm Darren Sonnier for kpcg.fm. In this age of information, in this 21st century, what is it that has shaped the way we work, the way we play, even the way we interact with other people? What has had the biggest and most dramatic impact on society in the past 20 to 30 years? We interact with it constantly and on a daily basis. It connects the world and makes even great distances seem non-existent. This incredible network that connects all our devices and allows us to accomplish incredible things, it is the internet. What started as the painfully slow dial-up connections that could only send documents and very small pieces of data has exploded into being able to stream high-definition video and the ability to store thousands of times more data than what we had with dial-up. Everything is affected by this incredible information highway. One of the biggest things that has changed is the way business is conducted and carried out. Just think about your workday for a second. You most likely do these daily or very often. You check your email. Have a video chat with a coworker or your boss. Work as a group on an important project, even though your offices are spread all across the country. And you type out a Word document and email it. All these have become daily tasks in the workplace. But just 20 years ago, much of this either didn't exist, or it was only accessible to the wealthy. You also most likely use a company login to access all of the information you require to work. Now imagine for a second that any one of these failed to function. Take email away, for example. Your office would be panic-stricken quickly. Just one single thing taken out for even a short period of time can cripple a business. Companies pay millions for backup generators and emergency power, just in case of a power outage. They also pay millions to store their precious data in cloud storage in the event of a major disaster. But most important of all is the connection to the outside world, the internet connection. If a business loses that, it costs them incredible amounts of money. Now take a look at your home life. What are some things you do on a daily basis at home? Most likely a number of these. You check your email. See the latest news on the website of your choice. Chat with friends on Facebook or Twitter. And stream videos and music. And you might even work from home. We've all been there. You're just trying to live your life, and all of a sudden, your internet connection is lost and goes offline. It's awful, right? You have no connection to the outside world. Unless you have mobile data on your smartphone, which more and more people have these days. One of the biggest parts that make up the internet are the many data centers spread across the world. These data centers house the tens of thousands of servers that run everything we interact with. Just to maintain and run YouTube alone, Google has data centers that are as long and wide as football fields, filled to the brim with servers processing the enormous amount of data that is uploaded to them every single day. These data centers are what run Facebook and Twitter, search engines like Google, and other websites and services. If it's on the internet, it is being hosted or run inside a data center. These data centers really are the backbone of the internet. Amazon is one of the companies that has capitalized on this, selling space and servers, or even renting them out to the thousands of businesses that require them. But what happens when a data center goes offline? It can be very costly and have grave consequences. Here's an example. Back in February, one of Amazon's many data centers went completely offline. The effect was felt instantly. In just seconds, millions of websites went down and could not be accessed. The outage affected a number of different companies, costing all of them millions. Although it was just one data center, social media was quick to explode with panic and unrest, some claiming the internet itself was completely down. While this was far from the truth, it does show us what happens when something that is depended on, and expected to be there, suddenly is not available. Amazon still hasn't disclosed what caused this sudden loss of a major data center. This was a small outage, in the grand scheme of things, but it can give us an idea of what can happen. Now imagine this. What if a cyber attack took out dozens of these data centers? The impact this would have would be unthinkable. Imagine, if you will, that not only is the internet offline for you, but for your whole neighborhood, your whole city, even your entire country. What kind of impact would that have on you and the people you know? It would be frightening, to say the least. You may start to see just how dependent we are on the precious connections we rely on every single day. The connections that enable this modern and connected world. Countries like China and Russia have entire sectors of their military devoted to cyber warfare. The internet is the great Achilles heel of the West, even more so in America. We have built our modern society around the incredible information highway we call the internet. But it is more vulnerable than we like to think, and we are heavily dependent on it. Are you prepared for the possibility of everything going offline? It would only take a planned attack from a nation, or even cyber terrorists, to take us offline and cut us off. It is only a matter of time before such an attack will come. So the next time you browse the web, or check your email, think about just how dependent on the internet we really are. For KPCG.fm, I'm Darren Sonnier.
Thanks, Darren. He's doing some good reports for us about some technology-related issues, including that one. What would you do if the internet went down? You didn't have the ability to get on there. That's a frightening thought. But, of course, it can happen. It does happen occasionally. And even just in day-to-day activity, sometimes the network goes down where you're working, or maybe you can't get a connection on your phone. And it's frustrating, to say the least. Sometimes it could be critical. So a pretty interesting report there. You're listening to Trumpet Radio Live on 101.3 KPCG. I'm Dwight Falk. Thanks for joining me today. And related to the technology side of things, of course, social media is changing the way people think about themselves and think about other people. And it's affecting what people are doing in their day-to-day lives. Young men are increasingly interested in the way they look. And a lot of it has to do with social media. People are more aware of their looks from different angles. And so they have a growing interest, young men do, in the way they are looking, to a point of taking it too far, probably. What are they doing because of this concern in the way they look? Well, you could call it Botox. They're getting plastic surgery or other things done related to that to try to change their appearance. And this is a write-up from Bloomberg, and it says, millennial men are bolstering the plastic surgery industry. It's a big industry. There's a lot of money there. Millennial men are the ones that are now really getting involved in plastic surgery, if you can believe that. Try to tell that to 20, 30-year-old men from a generation or two ago. I think they would be somewhat appalled by that. 31% of men said they were extremely likely to consider a cosmetic procedure, either surgical or non-invasive, according to a survey conducted by the American Academy of Facial Plastic and Reconstructive Surgery. Among that 31%, 58% were from 25 to 34 years old. 34% were aged 18 to 24. So young still, but wanting to change their appearance in unnatural ways. Both age ranges are members of the millennial generation. And so there's a chart here showing why the main reasons that these young men feel the need to get involved with cosmetic procedures. The top reason is they want to feel better about themselves. That was the number one reason that millennial men would get involved in cosmetic procedures. After that, it was to look less tired or stressed. I don't know. I would just probably try to go to sleep earlier. Another reason, the next reason was because they felt like their girlfriend or wife would like them better if they looked better in their minds anyway. Another reason they said was to stay competitive in their careers, and they thought a cosmetic procedure was the way to do that. The next one was to meet somebody. They think, well, if they look better, they'll have a better chance of those of meeting someone. And then finally, there were some that just didn't have any of those as their reasons, but they didn't disclose why they wanted to have these cosmetic procedures. So that's pretty interesting. And again, part of the reason that they're getting involved in some of these cosmetic procedures is because of the rise of social media, more aware of how they look, more concerned with what other people think about the way they look. And because of that, going in for plastic surgery, if you can believe it. That is something that is common to some extent anyway. We have probably all been someplace where we may have seen somebody and thought, that doesn't look quite right. There must be something going on there. And what happens a lot of times is people that get involved with cosmetic surgery end up regretting it. This is a related write-up from Courtney Cox. You might remember her. She was on Friends. That was probably where she's most famous from. And I've been in a few other shows, I think, since then, but I think that was her real claim to fame. Courtney Cox on giving up facial fillers. She says, I want to be as natural as I can be. So she went through quite a bit of cosmetic surgery, or I don't know exactly if it would be considered a surgery, but some sort of procedure, and then didn't like the results of it. She says, I grew up thinking that appearance was the most important thing. Isn't that funny? We're always told when we grow up, and we probably tell our children or other people, it's not, the looks aren't the most important thing. You always hear that. But yet, how many people really believe that? She says, Courtney Cox says, I grew up thinking that appearance was the most important thing. She says, that's kind of sad because it got me in trouble. I was trying so hard to keep up, and I actually made things worse, she explained, noting that doctors would often pressure her to nip and tuck here and there. And so that is the pressure, particularly for ladies, but now even for the men. They want to look young. But as they say, whether it's sports or other things, typically they say this about sports, father time is undefeated. No matter how good of a player you are, you get too old to play or to compete at some point. And particularly when people are involved in, say, sports or entertainment, at some point they're older. And oftentimes, since Hollywood is such a driven so much by young people and the younger generations, it's hard to find a place there. So there's a lot of pressure to stay looking young. And Courtney Cox says, well, what would end up happening is that you go to a doctor who would say, you look great, but what would help is a little injection here or a little filler there. She says, so you walk out and you don't look so bad and you think, no one noticed. It's good. I'm just keeping up. I'm maintaining. People won't notice it. And she says, then somebody tells you about another doctor. And they'll say, this person's amazing. They can do this procedure. It'll look so natural. It's so great. And so she says, you go and you meet them and you say, they say to you, hey, just go ahead and have this procedure done. Of course, they want to keep doing these procedures. And but she's 53 now, and she says she doesn't look like herself anymore. And there's pictures on the internet and on these stories where it does show with some of these more famous celebrities how they used to look, you know, how we do, I guess, remember them, and then how they look now. And in a lot of cases, it is quite a change. It is really shocking. They don't look like themselves anymore, and you can't, I don't know that you can undo it. It's pretty difficult. She says, the next thing you know, you're layered and layered and layered, and you have no idea because it's gradual. Until you go, oh no, this doesn't look right. And so it's a gradual change that they're making going through some of these surgeries. But then eventually they all pile up, they layer up, and there ends up being problems there. And it just doesn't look right. She says, I haven't done anything in 6 months. So she's trying to stop this. And you know, it can become addictive too. I've read stories about people who they're addicted to the surgeries. They just keep going for more and more and more. And it gets to the point where they don't even look like people anymore in some extreme cases. And sometimes I think that's the goal, actually. She says other friends told her differently, assuring her that she looked good, but eventually she said she had enough. So that's an interesting perspective there from Courtney Cox, someone who is famous, is a celebrity, was pressured, she says, to get a lot of these different procedures done. And then realized it changed her appearance and she didn't like the way it looked. So something to definitely think about if for those that are thinking about doing something like that, you may not like the results in the end. And so now it's even happening to younger and younger people, millennial men of all groups, which is surprising, bolstering the plastic surgery industry. So that's a write-up from Bloomberg. A couple other notes today. This is a write-up from Time Magazine talking about the change in some of the churches here in the U.S., in particular the Catholic Church. And they give some numbers. They say it's a changing church. Catholics are declining as the share of the U.S. population. 51 million. That's the number of people in the U.S. who were Catholic in 2014. Some 3 million fewer than in 2007, according to the Pew Research poll. Pretty big drop. Meanwhile, 56 million, that's the number of religiously unaffiliated adults in the U.S. In 2014, 19 million, that's 19 million more than it was in 2007. So those that used to be considered Catholic or considered themselves to be that dropped a fair bit, 3 million less since 2007, and 19 million more U.S. adults religiously unaffiliated, so not involved in that very much. Make sure you do listen for the Key of David program coming up here in a bit on KPCG. Also, the Trumpet Daily Radio Show with your host, Richard Palmer, today. And make sure you stop and check out thetrumpet.com as well. Top stories today have a lot to do with what's going on over there in Europe. Make sure you listen for those or look for those. France's radical election result could transform the EU. Also related to that, the next Eurozone crisis, and why the euro is heading for an earth-shaking crisis. Stop and check out those headlines at thetrumpet.com. If you are not a subscriber to the Trumpet Brief, it's a daily, not every day, but most days, an email that comes out, and it gives you just a brief insight into what's going on. Make sure you sign up for that. That's free at thetrumpet.com as well. A lot of people really like that and enjoy it. It's bite-sized. You can get through it, you know, in a quick read, but it's got a lot of great information showing you what's going on in the world. So you can sign up for that. It's free, and it is at thetrumpet.com. One last note today before we end the program. This is a write-up with a gentleman by the name of David Sedaris, and he is a American humorist, comedian, author, and radio contributor. And so he's written a few books, and he's written a new one. and it has to do with his diary. So I thought it was interesting just from the standpoint of writing in a diary. I don't know if you've ever tried that before. I think most people probably have tried it. It's hard to stick with it, sometimes because there's not a lot going on or it feels like there's not a lot to write about. It's not that important maybe, but some people stick with it, and there's probably some benefit to it. And so this is a quick write-up with David Sedaris, who's writing a book basically taking segments out of his diary from over the years. It's in Time Magazine. It says, things David Sedaris must do before bed if he wants a good night's sleep. He picks up litter from the streets near his home in West Sussex, England, where the local council named a garbage truck after him in appreciation. So he's a pretty clean guy, I guess. He has to clean all the dirty dishes, and then he writes in his diary. That is just something that he is doing. Since his first entry at age 20 in 1977, Sedaris has composed 165 volumes of private commentary, which he mined for his latest work, Theft by Finding, Diaries 1977 to 2002. So I don't know what he writes about in there. It might not be worth your time, but I just thought the idea of writing in a diary is worth looking at. So they asked him a few questions about it, and he said, they asked him, have you ever read a diary you weren't supposed to? And he said, in Chicago, I found this woman's diary in a trash can. She was one of those people searching for meaning in her life, going from one religion to another, going from one relationship to another. He said it was one of the best books he ever read. So apparently it was gripping. I don't know why you'd throw your diary out intact. It seems like you'd want to kind of get rid of the evidence. But in any event, he found it, and he said it was interesting to read. And they said, why are you such a diary devotee? He said, if you told me I couldn't write in my diary anymore, my life would be torture, and I'd have to get on some kind of other program. He says, stranded on a desert island, I'd just write my diary in the sand with a stick. The tide would wash it away, but I'd know that I'd written it down, and that would at least be something. So this guy takes his diary writing very seriously, and I think you have to if you're going to keep it up. You have to just make it a habit and routine and do it. They asked him, rereading your own writing, did you make any discoveries? He says, I don't like reading about my early years. He says, I was just very pretentious. It was hard to take that reading it. He said, but then again, you know, when you're 20 years old, you're an art student, you're going to be a little obnoxious. It comes with the territory. I think that's one of the things about writing in a diary. It can be embarrassing to go back and read it later. And so anyway, he's written this book. His name's David Sedaris. And it taken things from his diary. He's written a lot. Since his first entry at age 20 in 1977, 165 volumes of private commentary. So if you want to start a diary, I guess today would be the day to do it. See if you can get up to 165 volumes. That's all the time we have for today on Trumpet Radio Live. Thanks for joining me, Dwight Falk. And make sure you listen for the Key of David program, the Trumpet Daily Radio Show, and also check out thetrumpet.com. Have a great rest of your Thursday, and we'll talk to you again tomorrow.
You're listening to Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG.